What's up, guys? It's hotter than Satan's snatch outside, and that's why this episode's late. Welcome to the Millennial Rewatcher! Cue the fucking music. Guys, okay, I know it's hot as balls everywhere and I'm not in the hottest place on the earth, but listen, I've never done well with heat. I just don't, especially having lupus. Me and heat just don't agree. And it's been a struggle to record in this heat because I'm just at home here. I don't have a professional studio set up, nor do I have the means to try to rent space somewhere, which is really overwhelming for me anyway, because if it's a space where I'm not familiar with the equipment, I don't know how easy it's going to be to use. That's very, very overwhelming for me, which would mean that I would need to be able to book extra time, and that's more money. So anyways, my apologies for this episode getting out late. You know what? I can't fully blame it on the heat, though, because I unexpectedly had 2 days and 2 nights kid-free. I had intended for those days that I ended up having kid-free time to do podcast stuff. But when that opportunity of being childless and in my home by myself, just me and my dog, came up, y'all, all bets were off. I wasn't doing a motherfucking thing. And it was glorious. I got high a lot. I was in my garden. I read. I cleaned my house and it stayed that way. It was, you know what? This is a weird thing to say because I used to not think or feel like this. But as I've gotten older, and yes, I have 2 kids, I appreciate it so much more when I clean up my surroundings and then they stay that way because I'm the only one home and it feels fucking nice. I know there are people out there who are relating to this, so you get it. Anyways, I ended up watching this movie called The Love Witch. And y'all, listen, I was high. It was hot, but not as hot as it has been. And I had me a grand old fucking time cackle screaming reacting to this movie. I didn't finish it because it was 2 hours long. I was so into it, but the second I saw that the runtime was 2 hours, I disengaged. I was like, well, and now I'm out. So, but it was hilarious for a while. I don't even know how to describe that movie to you guys. I think it was on Hulu. It was interesting from what I watched. Not for everyone, but I appreciated it, especially aesthetically, because it was made in 2016, but it felt like it was made in the 60s. And I enjoyed that vibe. Anyways, today I'm going to do this a little bit different. Instead of giving you movie facts and such before the film, I'm going to do it after. Today we're doing Cool Runnings. Y'all, I've always loved this film. It's one of the films that I still actually have on VHS. No way to watch it on the VHS, but I have it. And apparently I'm really proud of that. It's on Disney Plus for anyone who has that or is interested in trying to check it out. Part of the reason I wanted to do Cool Runnings is not just because I love this movie, which I truly, truly do, but because Father of the Bride, although it's such a fun movie, it is a romantic comedy, I believe is how it's categorized. But that's how I see it. Because it's one of the movies I have such a strong attachment to, it was harder for me to revisit. And I just needed something that wasn't going to be a hard revisit for me. I don't know. Cool Runnings just popped into my fucking head. And I was like, that's it. That's what I'm doing. It's got to be Cool Runnings. So here we go. Like I said, I'm going to do my recap of the film first, and then we'll get into movie facts. But I mean, I am going to give you a little bit of just the director and the cast first. So Cool Runnings, it came out in 1993. It was directed by John Turteltaub. I should have looked that up, but I didn't. So here we are. The screenplay was written by Lynn Seifert, Tommy Swerdlow, and Michael Goldberg. And the story was written by Lynn Seifert and Michael Ritchie. For our cast, we have John Candy. I feel like I said that really weird. John Candy, who is iconic. John Candy, he definitely is in a few films that I have some big attachments to. For example, Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, which also, I almost said starves, also stars Steve Martin. I would love to talk about John Candy's life a bit more, but we're not going to do that today because I want to focus on Cool Runnings, but also the Jamaican bobsled team. For our athletes who play the four guys in the film that are the Jamaican team, there is Leon Robinson, who plays Darice Bannock. Dougie Doug. His name is Dougie Doug. I fucking love that. Plays Sanka Coffey. Raul DeLewis. It's D. Lewis, but it came out that way. Sorry. Plays Junior Bevel. And Malik Yoba plays Yul Brynner. It feels real weird to just start with the movie, but I do have a reason for doing that. But I'm also not going to let you know my exact reason until we get there. Anyways, here we are. Cool Runnings. Beginning of the film. This film, it opens with just the music and the culture and the colors and the Jamaican island. That kind of stuff will instantly get me. It just instantly reels me in. I personally love Jamaican culture. I'm not well versed in it. However, I really, really enjoy seeing and learning about Jamaica, which is another reason why I was very excited to revisit this movie. So it opens up and we are meeting our players. Player one, Darice Bannock. Darice Bannock, he's getting ready for, I believe, the 1988 Summer Olympics 100 meter sprint qualifier. He's pretty well known around the island, well beloved. So when the movie opens, he's sprinting. He's out for his daily routine to stay in shape and get ready for the qualifiers. He is following in the footsteps of his dad, who was an Olympic sprinter. His dad was also very well respected and loved on the island, and he has passed away, but his memory is it still lives on strong in their home. It's been Teresa's dream his whole life to be a sprinter, go to the Olympics. As he's making his run through town, he's saying hi to various people and such, and there's this one woman, it stood out to me because, listen, Darice, I mean, the actor, but, you know, for sake of sticking with the movie, Darice is very attractive. He's very handsome. And, there's one woman in the movie who agrees with me because she says,
"Handsome as a lion, that one. I could watch that backside all day."
I die. Because, girl, same. I will sit there sipping my coffee, whatever drink we choose to partake in. Who the fuck knows? I don't know. A gin and tonic is my choice of liquor, but I don't really drink anymore, so I'm good with water. Maybe coffee if it's not too hot. Iced coffee. I sound so basic, and you know what? That's fine. It is what it is. Next, we meet Sanka. Sanka is perhaps my favorite dude, my favorite guy in this film. He is so lovingly himself. He's so colorful, eccentric, kind of boisterous and loud. Loves to sing, and most of all, he loves being Jamaican. When we meet him, he's getting ready for a pushcart derby. That's kind of his thing, is he runs in the pushcart derby races on the island.
All right, team, let's get ready for the pre-race cheer. Ready?
Yes, sir!
Ready?
Yes, sir!
All right. One, two, three.
Toot. Who's the captain of our crew? Who's a friend to me and you? Kinda nice, good looking too. Sanka, Sanka, yay, Sanka!
Get back to work.
The best pushcart derby... my words. The best pushcart derby driver on the island is how he explains it. After we're kind of introduced to Darice and Sanka, we move into the day of the Olympic tryouts for the 100 meter sprint. Again, the 1988 Summer Olympics is what they're trying to qualify for. So obviously Darice is there, but when we're there, he also is going to meet two other guys who are our main characters as well. So there's Yul Brynner. He's bald. And they make some comments on it in the movie. And I'm not here to make fun of baldness, especially as someone who deals with a lot of fucking hair loss. I mean, I know I'm not a guy, but I also deal with hair loss. And someday a bitch might be bald. And you know what? If that happens, I already got a good set of wigs because I love me a wig. I'm hoping if that does happen to me, I can just accept it and rock it. You know what? I'm probably not going to. As I'm saying that, I'm like, Megan, you're lying to yourself, but one can hope, right? But I started referring to him as Baldy Brenner, and I know that sounds so mean, so I'm not going to keep doing it. I meant it as like a term of endearment, but the more I started calling him Baldy, the worse I felt. So I don't know why I'm telling you guys this, but I'm admitting it to you. Okay. Anyways, Brenner, he is a big, just like hunk of a dude. Okay, I feel like that came out as like hunk as in super attractive, and he's very attractive, but I meant it more as like he's a big, muscular, kind of intimidating guy, and he walks around with a chip on his shoulder, and he seems to be angry and kind of reactive in his anger a lot of the time. Very hot-headed, hard to talk to. And then we also meet Junior Bevel. And Junior is the absolute polar opposite of Brenner. Junior, he comes from a dad who grew up in poverty and then found his way out of it and made a lot of money. And at one point in the movie, Junior says his dad used to live in a shack and now he lives in one of the biggest houses in Kingston. So they live in Kingston, Jamaica. Anyways, Junior, he's very malleable. He is, he's determined, but quietly so. I immediately want to hug him. Anyways, the race begins. Junior is running in the middle of Big Brenner. I started calling him Big Brenner instead of Baldy Brenner. So I hope that's better, but... And Reese. And somehow Junior, he trips, it loses his footing, and he ends up taking down Brenner and Reese with him. Just like that, their dreams, their hopes of making it off the island and chasing their Olympic dreams are, they're dashed. They're lost at the lost footing of a stranger, that being Junior. And it's fucking devastating. It's super devastating watching the three of them on the ground there. They have the slow motion scene where you see the four guys, because there was four people who could qualify. So it had to be the top four racers, obviously, sprinters. And obviously it wasn't them. And they're watching these four guys celebrate in an instant. And listen, I don't even know how I would handle that. But it is devastating to see. So Derice goes to this guy. His name is Coolidge. And Coolidge is the head of the Jamaican Olympic Council. He makes his case. He begs Coolidge for a retry, explaining it wasn't his fault, blah, blah, blah. He was tripped by another racer. But Coolidge, he says rules are rules, and he can't make an exception. He won't make an exception. Personally, considering what happened, I kind of feel like there should be some sort of workaround, but I don't even know what that would look like, because there's still those four other guys who qualified, and they're going to the Olympics. So are we going to tell those guys, hey, this chance might be taken away from you because this one guy tripped and these two guys didn't get a fair shake? How do you work around that? So while it sucks, at the same time, I'm not even sure what the solution would have been there. Anyways, Derice sees a photo on Coolidge's wall in his office, and it's of his dad and somebody he doesn't recognize. So it turns out to be Irving Blitzer, or Irv for short. And he asks Coolidge, who the fuck is this guy? So Irv was shunned from the Olympic Games for cheating, stripped of his Olympic medals. Irv now lives on the island as a bookie. Coolidge says that lunatic was a bobsledder who tried to get your dad to switch sports. So Irv had came to the island looking for sprinters to turn into bobsledders. He believed that their athletic ability as a runner would be a great advantage in bobsledding, primarily in the push start timing portion of the bobsledding sport. So Derice decides this is it. This is the break he needs. This is how he's going to move on from what just happened and still go to the Olympics, especially because, I mean, bobsledding, obviously it's Winter Olympics, and the Winter Olympics in the film are right around the corner. So they also don't have a lot of time. Derice is now like, this is it. He believes that with Irv coaching a Jamaican bobsled team, they can make it. They can do this thing. So first, Derice goes to Sanka, because Sanka and him are really good friends. They've known each other since they were kids. And then he's also thinking, well, Sanka is a really amazing pushcart driver, so he's got to have an ability for this. He can definitely be a teammate. So he goes to Sanka, and essentially Sanka's like, you're out of your mind.
Ice. And it's kind of a winter sport, you know. You mean winter as in ice, baby? You mean winter as in igloos and Eskimos and penguins and ice? Possibly. See you. Where are you going? I want to take a hot bath. I'm getting cold just thinking about all this ice.
No, man. You're going to be part of my bobsled team.
What do you need me for?
Who is the best push car driver in all of Jamaica?
You're looking at him.
Then you gotta do it.
No!
Eventually, Dereese convinces him. And Sanka, at the end of the day, he believes in himself, no matter what. So once Dereese has convinced him, that's what he's doing.
Sanka, you're right. And you are my best friend. We've been through a whole lot together. Heave together. And I really, really need you. And I really, really need you. Forget it. What you just said, if I said that,
All right.
All right, man.
The two of them, they go find Irv. Irv frequents this local bar on the island. When they find him, he's listening to what I believe is a horse race on the radio because he's a bookie. He's definitely got bets out on the race. He's probably advised people to bet on whatever. So he's got money in this thing. My brain just tried to escape into some personal opinions on that, but it's not relevant. So I'm trying to... Dobby, I know. I'm trying to move on from it. I just got stuck there for a quick moment in my brain and I had to say it. Anyways, they're watching Irv interact with the radio because he's talking loudly. So Irv loses and he ends up beating the shit out of this radio with a pool stick.
Late stretch run. Tumbleweed held on momentarily, but realistically, only a fool would put their money on Tumbleweed. That horse had no chance of...
Despite this, I would have lost my fucking nerve, but not Dereese. They still approach him, and I know I've already said it, but I fucking love Sanka. Sanka, I love him so much. He just says,
"Greetings, Sled God.
We were just wondering if you'd be interested in coaching the first Jamaican bobsled team." Mm-hmm.
Dereese, love the radio? Radio? Stick? Sitting in the stick? Let's go!
And he'll continue to call Irv Sled God throughout the rest of the film. His delivery and just he himself, he's such a great fucking guy. They spend what seems like the rest of the afternoon trying to convince Irv to coach them. And Irv is like, you guys are fucking crazy. You're out of your minds. There's not enough time. You've never bobsledded before. Dereese, like, my God, the man does not give up. And he does it with a smile on his face the whole time. Dude is determined to the max. Finally, Irv's had enough, and he goes into this big, like, no speech.
No. Look, whatever your name is.
Dereese.
All right, Dereese. Let me lay out some difficulties for you. Snow. You don't have any. It's 900 degrees out there. Time. You don't have any. The Olympics are in 3 months. And me. You don't have me. As far as I'm concerned, the sport of bobsledding no longer exists. I don't want to do it. I don't want to coach it. And most of all, and I mean most of all, I don't want to be within 2,000 miles of anyone who does. Now, did you follow all that?
So yeah, Irv is giving it a hard no, but then Dereese, he just kind of quietly and silently says after Irv's speech there, "I'm Ben Bannock's son." And he slides the photo across the bar of Irv and his dad. He took it from Coolidge's office. Well, he did ask if he could have it. But anyways... he slides it across the bar, and that is what gets Irv's attention. He still is reluctantly agreeing. The thing about Irv is he's going to be real honest with you, but not honest in an asshole kind of way. It's not honest in like this egotistical kind of way, maybe at points, but for the most part, Irv's character, he gets shit done in a no funny business kind of way, but he's also honest. And even though he's done some fucked up shit in the past, and cheating and that kind of stuff, he knows that about himself and he doesn't like that about himself. So he's also kind of painfully self-aware, which, dear God, can I relate to that? Yeah, if you really pay attention to him, his intent is to get down to business and kind of weed out who and what is going to be serious as the rest of them. So he agrees to try to do this thing, but they still need to get two more teammates. So they put together this meeting. Irv has a bobsled slideshow.
You're on the air, Sled God.
Gentlemen, a bobsled is a simple thing.
Yes, so's a toilet.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Basically, what you're looking to do is get your sorry rear ends from the top of an icy chute to the bottom. You're zigging, you're zagging. It's the biggest, coldest roller coaster you've ever been on. I almost forgot one minor drawback to this delightful winter sport. The high-speed crash. That hurt. Always remember, your bones will not break in a bobsled. No, no.
They shatter.
Hey. So, who wants in?
A room full of people show up. But when the lights go up, everyone's gone. Everyone's gone except Big Brenner. And then Junior comes in because, listen, Junior's late. So he's like, has the meeting started yet? What's happening? And the lights are up. And when Brenner sees Junior, he's like, you're the guy who tripped me. And he kind of loses it. Regardless of how they feel about one another, if they're going to make this thing work, they got to work together. And Brenner, he's reminded, you want to get off the island, right? You want to chase your fucking dreams. You want to make it to the Olympics. You're going to have to get with this guy because he's the only other guy here to make up a team of four. And without him, you bitch, you only got three. That's just basic math. So they begin to train. We get this scene where Junior is practicing this talk he needs to have with his dad, who his whole life has reluctantly, but not really all that supportively, has let, that's how he puts it. So it's in quotes, let Junior chase his athletic Olympic girl dreams. But now that he hasn't qualified for the Summer Olympics, he expects Junior to just do as he says. So Junior's practicing this speech he's going to give to his dad about, now I'm going to be a bobsledder and not do what you say, to his super cute dog. He's got this big old like hound dog, and he's on the top of this cute blanket as Junior's polishing his bright red sports car. And it's so cute. But then his dad shows up. And he's very authoritative. He's very commanding. And he doesn't really give you room to say, no, I don't want to do that, or make a different choice, if that makes sense. So he loses his nerve. And his dad tells him, I found a job for you in Miami. And that's what you're going to do now that this nonsense is over with sports or whatever. And yeah, so Junior, he doesn't stand up to his dad. And he tells his dad he's going to go to Miami, but he's not going to go to Miami. So Irv goes to Coolidge to try to get the funding they need, but Coolidge, he's not giving him support. He doesn't want to do it. He says he can't support something that will make Jamaica look like an embarrassment to the rest of the world. I hate this. I hate that he says that. No one wants to give these guys a fair chance from before they even have started. And that's going to be a continuing theme up until the very end of the fucking movie. Irv tells Dereese what happened. They're not getting the funding that they need, but Dereese is not deterred. He still has this big old smile on his face, and he's like, okay, so we just got to find another way to do this.
No go, kid.
That's okay, Coach. We get the money.
Do the words give up mean anything to you?
Not a thing.
But really, they don't have any luck in their attempts to raise the money that they need on their own. In fact, everyone continues to laugh and point in their face like they're the biggest joke of a loser they've ever come across every time Dereese is this what it's for. Or anyways, I just, time after time, as we see more people laughing in their faces, I just want to slap them all and tell them to shut the fuck up. Why are you discounting them before they've even, like, you're not even it gets me going and then I can't even find my words. Okay, as they're each doing their thing trying to raise some funds, Big Brenner, his thing is he is trying to arm wrestle people to raise money. And y'all, I'm noting this scene, it's quick, but I'm noticing because he looks like a fucking pirate and I'm in love. I am obsessed with this. He's arm wrestling on a barrel. He ends up arm wrestling a woman that he loses to, and I kind of just fucking loved that as well, even though they're trying to make money. And I'm like, bitch, you're Big Brenner pirate now. Ultimately, Junior gets the money by selling his super cool red sports car. Dereese asks him, are you sure you want to do this? And Junior says,
Dereese, if I hadn't tripped you fellas, we'd already been going to the Olympics. I want you to have it.
You mean you want us to have it, right?
Right. Us.
In this moment, Brenner, he does kind of start to warm up to Junior a tiny, tiny bit because of this. But he's like, I still don't like you. And I'm just like, my dude, you don't know it yet, but you're about to be BFFs with this guy. You don't know it yet, but I do because I've seen the movie. Anyways, they fly into Calgary and they do not get a warm welcome because, of course, as I said, we're going to continue to see this theme until the fucking end of the movie. It's infuriating. Everyone keeps looking at them like they don't belong, like they've never seen a black man before. In the snow. I fucking hate it. So when they get there, Irv goes to register them at the official, like, you know, Olympic arena and whatever. And there's all these different tables, all the sports and stuff. So he goes to the bobsled table to register the team. And first, this guy, he asks what country Irv says Jamaica, and he asks him again, what country? And Irv's like, Jamaica. And that's when I notice that this fucking guy at the registration table is balding in the shape of an exclamation point on top of his rude, judgy head. And because he was a dick to Irv and therefore to Jamaica and the guys, the athletes in this moment, I'm saying it because I don't care. I also know it's a character and like I should be nicer because it's the actor. But you know what? For the sake of the movie and this podcast, that man is balding in the shape of an exclamation point, and I'm pointing it out because he was a dick. Anyways, they need a sled. Irv isn't exactly a welcome face back at the Olympic Games. There's quite a few people like, ma, it's been 12 fucking years. Also, what the fuck are you doing back here? Because you were kicked out for cheating. But I guess, hello? So it's not a warm welcome. And because of who Irv is, it's also making it extra harder on the Jamaican team. Because they're being associated with this guy. And you know what? Irv fucked up. He will fully admit, we'll hear in a little bit, that he is completely aware of how he fucked up. And he does want to make amends for that. And he's trying to do right by these guys. And he does want to give them a fair chance. But it's their proximity to him, it makes it triple as hard, unfortunately. He does manage to get an old practice sled from the American team. And he's supposed to pay $5,000 for this sled. It's truly a rust bucket. Truly, it is a fucking rust bucket. So they show up at the racetrack to practice on ice for the first time. So far, they've just been practicing on, you know, dirt, grass, whatever. It's a fucking sea of white faces staring them down like they have never seen a black man in snow before. I know I already said that, but it keeps happening. The Swiss in particular are big bullies right from the start, going against everything the Olympics is supposed to stand for, right?
Now listen up, fellas. I don't want you to worry about looking good out there.
Ah, Blitzy. You're going to tux him in, too?
Hey, seem into you like nobody likes us.
We're different. People are always afraid of what's different.
Listen, the thing is with the Olympics, you literally don't have to be a pro to go to the Olympics. You have to follow all the qualifying rules, but you don't have to be regarded as some pro athlete already. That's not how that works. And all countries are welcome, no matter your race. So it gets on my nerves. Their first run down the track, Sanka screams the entire fucking way. And listen, it is gloriously hilarious. In their hotel room, Sanka is cooking in a cast iron skillet on a hot plate while laying down in bed and reading a comic book. And it's just so perfectly Sanka, I can't get over it. So he's reading a comic book and Brenner starts giving him shit. He is kind of acting like a big overlord bully in this moment. But he makes this big speech about how he's going to make it big and famous. And when he does, he's going to live at this palace. He brings out this clipping that he carries around. And when he brings out this little magazine clipping, Sanka starts laughing at him.
And after I, Yul Brenner, win the Olympics and become famous, I'm gonna leave the island and live right down there. What are you laughing about? What are you laughing about?
That's Buckingham Palace. You plan on living there, you're gonna have to marry the queen.
I don't like this. I don't like how he laughs at him. I love Sanka, but I don't like how he laughs in his face. And I know Brenner has been giving him a lot of shit. It just, I guess it kind of triggers something for me because the clipping that Sanka whips out is it's like a magazine photo of Buckingham Palace. And Brenner just has no idea. He's like, when I make it big and famous, I'm going to live here someday. And it just, I don't know. It stole something in my heart when that happens because Brenner just kind of goes silent and he crumples up the photo and throws it. And he seems really ashamed and embarrassed and fucking hell. Obviously, I can't relate to the character or that situation at all because I am coming from a place of a white woman and he is coming from a place of a black man in a Tabby's snoring, in a poor country, Jamaica. I feel like it's unfair of me to relate to him in this moment because it's not the same thing. And I do understand that. I guess I just, on some level, can relate to that deep shame of yourself that seems to be coming across his face that sometimes I feel around my intelligence. And listen, I understand now that I have a much better and actual understanding of the way my brain works and my neurodivergence and learning disabilities, things like that. I don't actually believe that I'm stupid anymore, but I used to truly believe that, and people used to truly make me feel that way. So I guess that's kind of what I mean when I say I feel like something really pulls at me here, but I know it's not the same thing. So I just wanted to be clear on that, you know? Sanka starts laughing at him, but Junior, this is where Junior, he really steps in, and he's so kind, but not in like a pitiful kind of way. Junior explains that that's Buckingham Palace, but Junior also feels for Brenner. He's being very understanding.
Face it, you, Brenner. You can start calling yourself Madonna, but you're still going to end up in an out-house shanty like every other dock working nobody.
It says who?
It says me, rich boy. What you know about it?
He doesn't have to be. All he has to do is know what he wants and work hard for it. And if he wants it bad enough, he'll get it. Look, believe me, Sanka, the more Yul Brenners we got making it in this world, the better off this world would be. Especially for Jamaicans. Go ahead, Yul Brenner. Go get your palace.
So this is where truly where Brenner and Junior, they start to break down some barriers and form a real friendship. As they continue to practice, they're being publicized for the world to laugh at that. I mean, when we hear the radio casters and see the newspaper headlines in the movie, it's all poking fun at them. And they're just being so ostracized and outcast and ridiculed from all these different directions. I can't even imagine. But because of that, and I mean, obviously, it's the Olympics as well. Junior's dad, he was bound to, but he finds out that Junior is not in Miami like he's supposed to be. So Junior gets a telegram from Dearest Daddy commanding him to come home. And then later that night, they go line dancing and Junior's really down. Brenner's asking him, what are you going to do? Sanka's having the time of his life trying to line dance. Sanka, he just jumps in and he's like, what's this thing? I'm going to try it. And he does. I wish I was that way. I truly do, but I'm just not. So the Swiss are also there. And of course, the head Swiss bitch guy starts making fun of them, especially Junior, who's used to taking shit from other people and he doesn't stand up for himself. But Big Brenner, Mr. Brenner, he decides Junior needs a pep talk.
Now look in the mirror and tell me what you see.
You see Junior.
Well, you want to know what I see? I see pride. I see power. I see a badass mother who don't take no crap of nobody.
You really see all that?
Yeah, man. But it's not about what I see. It's about what you see. Now look in this mirror and tell me again what you see.
Well, I see...
pride.
Pride.
Right. Power.
Power.
A badass mother
who won't take no crap off of nobody.
Again!
I see pride.
Can't hear you.
I see power. I see a badass mother who won't take no crap off of nobody.
Once again!
I see pride.
Junior!
I see power. I see a badass mother who won't take no crap off of nobody.
That's right!
Junior Bevel.
Wait, what are you going?
Listen, Junior gets so invigorated that he confronts Swiss Bitch. But then Brenner has to step in and help him out and a fight breaks out in the bar. And then fucking Sanka, he's still line dancing, but he notices that there's a fight happening and he notices that, oh, those are my guys. So no fucking questions asked. No questions asked. He just takes a fucking swan dive into the fight. I don't think he had any intention of actually fighting. I'm pretty sure he's just going to flail about. But that's also another thing that I just find so endearing about Sanka. But he also just like takes a dive in and doesn't really think about what he's going to do next. It's the night of the qualifying race. And of course, Irv is told that the qualifying time has just changed. How convenient. from a minute two to a minute flat. But listen, they fucking pull through and they qualify. They make it under a minute and they qualify. So the guys are celebrating. They're painting their sled. They're thrilled. They're so fucking excited.
Oh, hi. You are great. Nobody had that much fun in a sled since Santa Claus. Fellas, used to follow your dreams.
Follow your dreams. I said it to your father the first time I met him, and I'll say it again. Sprinters make the best bobsledders. He's the sprinting!
They feel so good about themselves. They're ready to go. But then they get a notice that they've been disqualified. And Irv is big mad. Big Irv mad. And he goes straight to the council because he's not fucking having it. The council made a last minute change to the qualifying terms that just so happened to disqualify the Jamaican team.
The Alliance has the right to do whatever they feel is in the best interest of the sport.
We must also be concerned about the potential for embarrassment. Oh, forgive me. I didn't realize the four black guys in a bobsled could make you blush.
Irv knows that a lot of this is happening because of the way the council and some very particular people in high places feel about Irv. And he kind of makes this amazing speech.
Come on, Kurt. What you're doing is wrong and you know it. Now, this is about you and me. And let's get it straight right now. All right, 16 years ago, I made the biggest mistake of my life. I cheated. I was stupid. I embarrassed myself, my family, my teammates, my country, and my coach. If it's revenge you want, take it. Go ahead. Disqualify me. Banish me. Do whatever you want, but do it to me. It was me who let you down, Kurt. It wasn't my guys. They've done everything you've asked of them, and they did it with all of you laughing in their face. Hell, it doesn't matter if they come in first or 50th. Those guys have earned the right to represent their country. They've earned the right to march into that stadium and wave their nation's flag. That's the single greatest honor an athlete could ever have. That's what the Olympics are about. 16 years ago, I forgot that. Don't you go and do the same.
So his speech was risky, but it works. And they're back in the game. They have been re-qualified. I don't even know how to word that, but here we are. The opening ceremonies commence. Everyone back home is watching, and it's fucking beautiful. The night before the first race, Irv has this pretty good speech for them that I'm a little bit obsessed with.
Now, a lot of coaches will be giving you one of those win one for the Gipper speeches. I'm not good at that stuff. Instead, I thought I'd lead you in a psalm of inspiration. Let's bow our heads.
Who's the Gipper?
Our Father, who art in Calgary, bobsled be thy name. Thy kingdom come, gold medals won, on earth as it is in turn seven. With liberty and justice for Jamaica and Haile Selassie. Amen.
All right. Yes.
But right after this, Junior's dad shows up, and it's very deflating for Junior. And you know what? It just pisses me off because even though his son has literally made it to the Olympics, he demands he stops. He says, stop playing around and come home. So when his dad shows up, he comes straight to their hotel room and Junior steps out in the hallway and falls into the elevator as his dad is talking to him and just telling him what to do again. Treating him like his ambitions and his athleticism is a fucking joke and it's not. He's amazing and he's not giving his son a chance to be who he really wants and needs and can be. It's so suffocating and sad to me. As his dad is entering the elevator again and he's saying, meet me in the lobby. Junior catches a glimpse of himself in the mirror and he's brought back to the conversation and pep talk that Brenner had with him. And this is when he finally stands up to his dad and it's beautiful.
Father, when you look at me, what do you see?
I don't have time for games, Junior.
Tell me what you see, please.
All right, I'll tell you what I see. I see a lost little boy. Who is lucky to have a father who knows what's best for him?
No. You don't know what's best for me, Father. I am not a lost little boy, Father. I am a man. And I'm an Olympian. And I'm staying right here.
Unfortunately, they totally blow the first race. Because even though they have the athleticism, they still aren't showing up as themselves. And therefore, they're not showing up as a unified team and unit. They've been so worn down and outcast by literally fucking everyone. They keep trying to be like other teams and it's messing with them. Big Mad Irv is big mad again and says they better figure it out before they show up to the next day's race. He leaves and Dereese, he starts to say something about the Swiss again because he's kind of been hyper-focused on learning from the Swiss and trying to race like them. But Sanka's had enough of that.
When the Swiss want to get shut up about the damn Swiss. I mean, it was all that Ein's vine dry nonsense that got us all nervous in the first place.
Hey, man, look here. I'm just trying to get us off on the right foot.
Well, the right foot for us is not the Swiss foot. Let me tell you something, Rasta. I didn't come up here to forget who I am and where I come from.
And neither did I. I'm just trying to be the best I can be.
So am I. And the best I can be is Jamaican. Dereese, I've known you since Julie Jeffries asked to see you ding-a-ling. And I'm telling you as a friend. If we look Jamaican, walk Jamaican, talk Jamaican, and is Jamaican, then we sure as hell better bobsled Jamaican.
Thank you, Sanka. Fucking thank you, Sanka. So day two, they show up to the track Jamaican. Jamaican and proud.
Feel the rhythm. Feel the rhyme. Get on up. It's bobsled time. Cool running.
And they fucking kill it. They pull themselves from last place to eighth. Listen, their speed going into the bobsled, I believe, is better than the Swiss. And everyone has now fallen in love with Jamaicans. With the Jamaican team back home, they're just so fucking elated. Everyone is entranced by what is happening.
Where do these guys come from?
Jamaica!
So after this, we get this scene later that night, the night before the third race. There's four official races in bobsled. So this is the night before the third one, where Dereese asks Irv why he cheated. Dereese knows that he cheated. He knows what happened. Irv had put a weight in the front of the bobsled for the team that he had been coaching at the time to make it go faster. And that got them disqualified. Dereese knows this, but he still hasn't asked him, why did you do it? You were already a winner. You already had made gold. What made you feel like you had to do that? And Irv, he says this line that honestly will probably stick with me for the rest of my life. He says,
Dereese, a gold medal is a wonderful thing. But if you're not enough without it, you'll never be enough with it.
If you aren't good enough without it, you'll never be good enough with it. And then Dereese asks him, how will he know if he's good enough? And Irv tells him,
when you cross that finish line, you'll know.
It's the third race day. Everyone's finally on board. They're rooting for the Jamaicans, the fucking commentators for the Olympics as the race is happening. They're all of a sudden, we love Jamaica, even though they had just been fucking total assholes to them, you know, 2 days prior. But now everyone is rooting for Jamaica. They start the race really, really strong. They just bolt out of there at fucking lightning speed, doing better than even yesterday. But as they're racing down the ice, we see bolts loosening in their rust bucket sled, because remember, they don't have a top of the line sled. They have an old practice sled that's worn down. It's not in good shape. And ultimately they crash. It's harsh, it's scary, and the world seems to fall to a complete hush from the devastation. But Dereese and the others, they are determined to cross the finish line.
Dereese, you're dead?
No, ma'am. I'm not dead. I have to finish the race.
No one's hurt. They get out of the sled and they pick it up and they're like, we're still going to finish this. Even if they have to pick up the sled and walk it over the finish line to do it. So they get up and they do exactly that. They pick up the sled and a slow clap begins. And then a roar of applause. and it continues as they walk their way to the finish line. We see Junior's dad in the crowd wearing a shirt in support of them. As Dorice is getting closer to the finish line, you can definitely tell that he's starting to understand that even though they're finished, they're not going to win, they're not going to go on to the final race, they're not going to get a medal, he still feels good enough. You can see it in his eyes. And he's waiting to see what he's going to feel like when he crosses under that finish line, under that banner. And when he does, you can just see it all over his face. He's still so proud of himself. He's still so proud of how far he's come and what they did. And he knows that he is good enough. So when he crosses that line, Irv comes up to him and they thank each other.
Thanks, Irv.
Thank you.
They've both grown and learned and evolved, and they thank each other. And you just know that in his own eyes, he is a winner. Both of them. It really feels like Irv has healed something and Dorice has accomplished something, even if it doesn't look like what he thought it was going to look like or wanted it to. The movie ends with a photo of Dorice and Irv hung right next to the photo of Dorice's dad and Irv in Coolidge's office, and it's pretty cool to see. The thing is, I want to get into just a little bit of movie facts and some real life facts about the Jamaican bobsled team, the first Jamaican bobsled team. But I just wanted to note, as I was finishing my first watch and every watch of this movie, it's really important to me to talk about how, even though the movie ends on a good note, these men should have had the respect of every single person at that event and around the world the second they showed up, and they didn't. That's not what the Olympics is about, and it's a clear picture of racism. And we also can't ignore the fact that access to resources is a hugely important factor here, because had they showed up with more money and the ability to get hold of a brand new top of the line sled with maintenance and all that stuff, the outcome of this could have been very different. But the reality is that they came from a poor country and no one wanted to support them. No one wanted to give them a chance just because they were Jamaican. And a Jamaican couldn't possibly bobsled, right? How absurd is that? They showed up without the advantage that money could buy them. And I know that not every country is going to show up to an event with the most amount of money for the most amount of advantages, or however you want to word that. But at the same time, had their circumstances been different, this could have been a much different outcome. What I wanted to specifically point out and talk about, and why I did the movie recap before my discussion, I guess, or, you know, facts and such. This is one of those movies that I have such a large endearment to that it wasn't until I did the research of this movie did it occur to me that it might not be factual. Because for me, when I get that really big rush of endorphins and that, I guess, dopamine hit of endearment and then nostalgia, I love how the story unfolds. I love the music. I love the colors. I love the Jamaican culture. I love seeing these men come out on top, even if it wasn't a technical win. When I get into that space, I can lose all ability to grab onto my media literacy and look for the real facts. Unfortunately, most of this movie is not factual. And again, that could also lead into discussion about suspending your reality and such, which is fine. But at the same time, when I was doing the research, there's just certain things that kind of niggled at me and made me feel off about some stuff. So for example, I was on the official Olympic site, and they do have a page, I'll have it in the show notes with all my other links and stuff, about the Jamaican bobsled team. And then it does talk about the movie in reference to factual events. And one of the things it says on the site is Cool Runnings, for the most part, is inaccurate. For example, the team did not pick up their sleigh and carry it over the line. Instead, they walked it. They walked next to it. They didn't carry it. The film also suggests that it was a mechanical fault, referring to the crash. But in reality, it was excess speed combined with driver inexperience that caused the crash. And that last sentence, the driver inexperience and excess speed. Listen, I don't know enough about bobsledding and speed on the ice to really speak on that. It would seem to me, I mean, you're trying to be the fastest, so that's an interesting statement to me. But what stood out to me more was driver inexperience that caused the crash. Listen, so the driver, who the athlete's name, his real name in real life was Dudley Stokes. And when they were training for the event, he had a minor shoulder injury. And although it's minor, not enough to put him out of the race, that's still going to affect his ability to compete. And instead of them saying injury to the athlete, or however you might have worded that, they wrote driver inexperience that caused the crash. And that fucking bothers me. because it's inaccurate. And the fact that it's blatantly on the official Olympic site and written that way pisses me off even further. Because if we're going to talk about how the movie isn't factual, then you better talk about the real fucking facts and not continue to use misinformation. Because it's very dismissive of those men. And it's very dismissive of what they did. And what they did is extremely important and significant. It was a huge boost for Jamaica. Not only was it a moment of pride to see their team, their country represented there in an event they'd never been represented in before, it inspired other men and women from Jamaica to compete in such events and pursue such athleticism. And let's not fucking undermine that, okay? That's not okay. And I'm just not fucking here for it. And it was really important for me to point that discrepancy out. So I did find a lot of good articles that are firsthand account interviews from the guys on the team. So I do want to go over those, one of those a little bit, but most of the information, if you want to hear, there's like some YouTube interview, well, videos on YouTube that are interviews of all of the men, the actual athletes, and then some newspaper articles I'll also link for you guys to read about. There's one that it was an interview with Dudley Stokes, but I'm gonna talk a little bit more about Devin Harris in a minute here. My dog keeps farting next to me. According to everything I was reading, not much in the movie Cool Runnings actually happened in real life. In the real story, Jamaica entered two bobsled teams at the Olympics. So there's a two-man competition and a four-man competition. So Dudley Stokes and Michael White, they were the two-man team with Devin Harris and last-minute replacement Chris Stokes joining them for the four-man. So Chris Stokes is Dudley's brother, and he was initially just there to support and watch, but he ended up being tapped in when another one of their teammates was injured and couldn't compete anymore. I also wanted to note that Cool Runnings, it was actually John Candy's final film released in his lifetime. Oh, and I did forget to note that it was composed by Hans Zimmer. I wanted to say that earlier and I spaced. Jamaica was disqualified, so that was factual as well. They were disqualified by the International Olympic Committee for late entry into the competition, blah, blah, blah. But there was pressure from several appeals, including one so from Prince Albert of Monaco, who had competed in the event himself. The appeals and the appeal from Prince Albert of Monaco led to the reversal of decision of them being disqualified. So I just thought that was kind of, that was pretty cool, a pretty cool fact. And I just want to share that with you guys as well. Let's get into the real story a bit more. And a lot of this is taken from an interview and an article that was done on Devin Harris. So in 1987, two American businessmen, George Fitch and William Maloney, I almost said baloney, were living in Jamaica and were inspired by a local pushcart derby to form the country's first bobsled team. With the support of the Jamaican Olympic Association, the Americans first set their sights on recruiting track stars who didn't qualify for the Olympics. But they also spoke to the Jamaican Defense Force and got the help of Colonel Ken Barnes to recruit players. Among those recruits was Devin Harris, who was 22 at the time and serving in the Jamaican Army. He was a middle distance runner who tried out for the 1984 Summer Olympics but didn't qualify. The team was funded by George Fitch and the American Tourism Board. So that is another difference in the movie. They don't receive funding from, you know, anyone. Junior gets them the fucking money. But that's not actually how it happened in real life. Yeah, the original recruits, they were not former track stars, but three members of the Army. Captain Dudley Stokes, Lieutenant Devin Harris, and Private Michael White. And then a civilian, Samuel Clayton. The four men, they trained for 3 hours a day next to a soccer field in the Army barracks using a makeshift sled. Just a month after training together, they then went to traveled to Lake Placid in New York, which I literally just watched the movie Lake Placid. I honestly might do that as my next movie. So when I saw that, I was like, is that a sign? That's definitely the next movie I should do. We'll see. But yeah, they went to Lake Placid in New York to train on the tracks there. The team, they later trained in Calgary and as well as in Austria, and then back to Lake Placid. So yeah, I mean, that differs a lot from the movie. That's not how it was depicted at all. Along the way, they did pick up two more players, Frederick Powell and Caswell Allen. Such a cool name, Caswell. I love that. So I read that before, but I just sang it out loud or something about it that's just, I don't know. I would name a dog that. Sorry, no offense to anyone named Caswell. It's a great human name too, okay? When they returned to Calgary in February of 1988, they were welcomed warmly by their peers, unlike the film. And Devin does say, quote, in the film, they stretched the truth on racial discrimination. Athletes generally don't treat each other that way. Listen, I can't speak to racism within the Olympic Games. I don't know enough about it. I definitely would like to do some research on that. So that's something I will probably have to get back to you guys on the future if I learn anything more about that. But this is his firsthand account experience. And of course, that doesn't speak to everyone's experience at all. And I would be a fool to say that there's no racism in the Olympics. It's everywhere. So, but it is nice to hear that, at least in Devin Harris's words, that that wasn't their overwhelming experience for the most part. A week before the Olympics, Caswell Allen injured his hand and had to be replaced. So that's when Dudley Stokes' brother Chris, again, who was at the games, but this guy had never been in a bobsled. He was a last minute replacement. Devin says, quote, "We're like, Chris, you're a sprinter, right? Come on." So 3 days, we taught him everything we knew. And then at the end of the week, we pushed the 7th fastest time, end quote. So again, that was from Harris's his words himself. This is the line. Driver Dudley Stokes, who had suffered a shoulder injury during training, lost control of the sled on a turn and the team crashed, forcing the sled onto its side. So Cool Runnings, the movie, it does use some footage from the actual crash. It's toned down, but there is some actual footage used. Devin says, quote, "When you're in a crash, there's not much you can do. Just have to go for the ride. And it's an interesting experience because you just see flashes of white that's going by and you hear the sled scraping on the ice. And it's a horrible sound in your ear. And then you smell the burning of fiberglass. A sled is very small, the four of you in very confined space. And so if you panic, you make it worse. So you just lay there and you just come to an end," end quote. Like I said, that really weird, but here we are. Harris said that the crash was the lowest part of their experience in Calgary. I mean, of course it was going to be, but it also fueled their desire to come back. He said, quote, "The crash made sure we came back." Again, the team pushed the sled over the finish line. They didn't carry it as depicted in the movie, but people did wave and cheer just like in the film. While the Hollywood Disney version doesn't reflect reality, Devin Harris did say it captured the essence and spirit of the team. Harris did say that all of his teammates, they enjoyed the movie. And he also said that he was originally super anxious about how the real life characters would be depicted, but ultimately was pleased with what he saw in the film. He said, quote, "Relief was my first reaction because there was concern about stereotypes of Jamaica, like smoking weed, and none of my team has ever smoked weed," end quote. I just really enjoyed reading his firsthand account words. I also read the interview that was from Dudley as well. And honestly, like I said, there's lots of information out there, videos and interviews you can watch of the actual guys, the true story. And I just want to encourage everyone to familiarize themselves with that. It's a cool story. And I love learning about the boundaries that they pushed and what they did for Jamaica and for themselves and their families, you know? So Harris, he did go on to continue to compete in the 1992 Olympics in France. Devin Harris, he became the captain of his team. He also captained the 1998 team in Japan before retiring from Olympic competition. He then became the Secretary General of the Jamaican Bobsled Federation, as well as a motivational speaker, philanthropist, and author. He says, quote, "I feel a responsibility to inspire. All of us have that responsibility to do what we can to help the next person." He also runs the Keep On Pushing Foundation to help feed children in impoverished areas of Jamaica. And I'm going to include a link to donate to that in the show notes. So please check that out. Before I let you guys go, I did just want to tell you one more fact, because in 2018, Jamaica got its first women's bobsled team. So they competed in the two-person race, Jasmine Fenletter-Victorian and Carrie Russell. Jasmine, she did previously compete for Team USA, but she has dual citizenship in USA and Jamaica. Carrie Russell, she's an elite Jamaican sprinter. She was the pushman and brakeman for the sled. And then there was Audra Segree, who is also a sprinter, and she was picked as an alternate brakeman for the sled, just in case anything happened and they needed to put someone else in. In an interview with Jasmine Fenletter, I apologize if I'm saying that wrong, she said that while the men's team, they didn't win any medals, they did break down some barriers. Quote, "In 1988, if you looked at the starting line, you wouldn't find many minorities whatsoever. It was a very European, white-dominated sport. It also was dominated by people with money. Mm-hmm. If you can get the funding, or if you knew people with money, you had the best equipment and could travel and afford to tour. Another stereotype is, if you've never seen snow before, or you've never been around snow, how can you bobsleigh? And I think a lot of those cultural differences is what held back quite a few nations from kind of exploring the option. She went on to say, "I'm a dual citizen. I'm biracial, so my mom is second generation born in the U.S. Her grandmother came over from Latvia and her background being European. And my dad came to the States in the late 70s, early 80s. So it was always important for me to represent both sides. You know, my parents never said I had to choose to be Jamaican or choose to be American. Yeah, I just thought that that was really cool to read and see, and that they are continuing the legacy of Jamaican bobsledders. I just found that quote to be kind of powerful. I love that she's speaking the truth and laying it out how it is. The end. That's all I have for you guys today. I really hope you enjoyed this episode and my recap and discussion on Cool Runnings. As I said, I think I might be doing Lake Placid next. Listen, Betty White is in that movie, and I forgot that she's in that movie, so it was a fucking treat to watch it again and see Betty White be super badass, because she's kind of the villain in that movie. Listen, I'm here for it, okay? I'm super fucking here for Betty White villain. Let's fucking go. Anyways, as I said, all my references and such will be in the show notes. Please check out those links. Don't forget to subscribe so you can get a little notification the next time when my next episode is out. I will continue to try to get them out on time. I promise this is not going to be a reoccurring thing. But, you know, when it's my fault, I try to own up to it and then blame it on the heat, apparently, because that's what I did initially. All right, guys. Thanks for listening. Okay, bye.
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 I am feeling very Olympic today. How about you?